Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to New Books in Psychology. My name is Eugenio Duarte. I'm your host, as well as a psychoanalyst and clinical psychologist in Miami. Today, we are talking about capitalism, but not simply as an economic phenomenon, but as a psychological and emotional one as well. My guest today is Todd McGowan, author of the new book, Capitalism and Desire, The Psychic Cost of Free Markets, published in 2016 by Columbia University Press. Todd McGowan is Associate Professor of Film Studies at the University of Vermont. He is the author of the book, Enjoying What We Don't Have, The Political Project of Psychoanalysis, published in 2013, author of the book, Universality and Identity Politics, published in 2020, and the book, Only a Joke Can Save Us, A Theory of Comedy, published in 2017, among other books. I'd like to welcome him. Hi, Todd. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
I'm happy to have you here. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and about the kinds of things that you like to write about?
Yeah. So I went to Ohio State University and I got a PhD in English. And when I was there, I got interested in German idealism, so Hegel, Kant, and psychoanalysis. And so that's how I, you know, that's the beginning of the road that led me to this book. And I basically wrote this book because there's been a lot of, obviously, you know, there's been a lot on psychoanalysis and capitalism and bringing together psychoanalysis and Marxism, like Herbert Marcuse, Theodor Adorno, the whole Frankfurt School. But I felt like that was all the way that they thought about capitalism was through the idea of repression. And I thought, well, that doesn't seem right to me. And so part of the driving motivation behind this book was how can I change that critique and think more about what capitalism does well for us psychically or how it appeals to us psychically rather than how it just damages us psychically. So it's not a book pro capitalist book, but it's about how capitalism works really and psychically and not about how it fails. And so I think that's where I saw a space that people didn't talk about.
So before we get into the critiques of capitalism that came before you and the fresh take that you're offering, I want to clarify for our listeners one of the basic premises of your book, which seems to be, as I read it, that capitalism is not just an economic issue. It's a psychological issue. It's a psychological phenomenon. Can you explain how that is so?
Right. So that's really important to me, that it's psychic as much as it is economic or social, right? And so the idea behind that is that capitalism has a fantasy attached to it, that we can, if we accumulate enough or we accumulate the right commodity, then we achieve some perfect satisfaction, perfect enjoyment. And that's, I think that's a nefarious fantasy. And so the way in which that impacts just every, like, I think if you, I think I say somewhere in the book that, I think this is in the chapter on love and romance, that in every commodity you buy is like the idea of the soulmate is written into it. So even if you go to buy like a pack of nails at the hardware store, there's lurking behind that this idea that I could find some like this, you complete me, this figure of the soulmate in that commodity. And so that's kind of where I was getting that's crucial to how I think of capitalism, that idea that it's this psychic phantasmatic dimension is just as important as the economic dimension in my mind.
But are you saying that allure of the, you know, the box of nails at the hardware store and how it's going to be the perfect box of nails, am I understanding you right as saying that that's an illusion?
Right, that it's impossible to have like that. I think one of the great ideas of psychoanalysis, this is maybe my favorite idea of it, is that we're lacking subjects, and no matter what we do, we're going to remain lacking subjects. So the idea that we could somehow overcome that is written into every commodity. And yeah, that's an illusion, right? Like there's no commodity is going to bring this sense of completion that we anticipate that it's going to bring. And so I think that's really important for how capitalism functions ideologically and psychically, and then why it's misleading.
You know, if it's all right with you, I want to read some quotes from your book because I want our listeners to get a sense of what a great writer you are. And I'm looking at page 2, and I want to read a section and have you talk about it. You say, most of the attempts to understand how capitalism works have focused on its economic structure on the social effects that it produces. While important, these approaches necessarily miss the primary source of capitalism's staying power. The resilience of capitalism as an economic or social force derives from its relationship to the psyche and to how subjects relate to their own satisfaction. This is why psychoanalysis is requisite for making sense of capitalism's appeal. Psychoanalysis probes the satisfaction of subjects and tries to understand why this satisfaction takes the form that it does. Can you explain what you're saying here about the role of satisfaction in your understanding of capitalism?
Yeah, so it's a double thing, right? So on the one hand, there is something satisfying about just the repetition of I go to buy the commodity and then I find it, there's something that's not quite perfect about it. So then I go to buy another commodity and then there's something not quite perfect. So there's something satisfying just about that repetition itself. I think that's a real satisfaction in that. But then there's this illusory idea of I can find this complete satisfaction in a certain commodity that I find or a certain amount of work that I do. So it can work. It can be on the side of production or on the side of consumption. I think both equally. And that's illusory. So I think capitalism kind of has both things going for it. It has on the one hand, this real satisfaction of this repetition that is a repetition of a failure. And then a failure that of getting the object, but which is nonetheless there's something satisfying about it. And then on the other hand, this illusory idea of a perfect satisfaction that is never found, but keeps luring us in.
You know, in a moment, I want to come back to this issue of, you know, what is satisfying about the dissatisfaction. But you mentioned at the beginning that there have been other critiques of capitalism that focus on repression in capitalism. Can you explain what that critique is and how yours is different?
Yeah. So I think the best figure of this is Herbert Marcuse. And his idea is that capitalism, he thought, okay, there's a certain amount of repression necessary to live in society. But he thought capitalism causes what he called an excess repression surplus repression. Which means that it demands we have to sacrifice more of our desire because of the inequalities of capitalism and the excesses of capitalism. And so that repression means we don't get to fulfill our desire for Marcuse. And so there was a real link between Marcuse's thought and the liberation movements of the 1960s, which thought like we can, they linked capitalism to sexual repression, right? And their idea was, if we lift the repression that happens in capitalism, something happens congruently with sexual repression. And so those two things can go hand in hand. And Marcuse was a leading figure in both of those movements. And I think we can see that capitalism works perfectly well with the lifting of sexual repression, right? Like, I mean, I think of the last 50 years have shown us anything. They've shown us that sexual repression is not necessary to the functioning of capitalism. In fact, it's kind of a detriment to it, that it works better if there's less sexual repression and more free, open sexuality. So that's the key for me. And my idea is that, no, it's not repression so much as this idea that we can fulfill we can actually get our object, right? So that's where capitalism misleads us. It's not so much we have to repress our desire. It allows us to allows our desires to be fulfilled, but it creates this illusion that we can really get this object, this most precious object that we want, whereas structurally we cannot. It's like psychically we cannot. Like, our psyche is structured, I think, around missing the object, and that there's a satisfaction in missing the object. I think this is, to me, again, Freud's great idea.
Before we leave the repression hypothesis, so that we understand, I mean, can you give an example or explain in what ways does capitalism make us repress our desires? Is there like a day-to-day example in which that would be the case?
Well, I think for Marcuse, I think that he would have said, and he does say, like, you know, you have to go to work from 8 to 5 or even more, rather than, I don't know, going to the beach and laying out naked and having sex, right? Like, there's all these things that you'd rather be doing. I mean, I wouldn't rather be doing that. I'd rather be in a factory working from 8 to 5. But a lot of people, I think, I mean, for Marcuse, like sexual activity, I mean, and other Frank, like for Theodor Adorno, it would be listening to the opera, right? Like, you, rather than listening to the opera, you're forced to work in this mindless job for 40, 60 hours a week, right? So that would be repression. I think that's the repressive hypothesis. And it's, I even said the term repressive hypothesis. So one of the critiques of this idea is from the French writer Michel Foucault, who says that it's wrong to ever think of repression. And so part of my book is saying, well, maybe Foucault, I don't usually agree with him, but maybe he's right about this, that capitalism doesn't involve repression, that there's something else at work. So that idea of repression, there's a lot of criticism of it because of what followed after the 60s, but also it just didn't seem right, I think, to people.
So let me see if I can synthesize, and you let me know if I'm getting it or if I'm off.
Sure.
Are you saying, you know, that one critique of capitalism has traditionally been it makes us give up the things that give us joy in life, the things that give us pleasure, because we got to go to work, we have to produce, and so necessarily we give up those joys. And you're saying, you know, that is one critique, but you're presenting a different critique that says, no, that's not the main problem with capitalism. The main problem might be that it structurally is designed so that our desire is actually never satisfiable.
Well, right. I mean, that's right. Right. So yeah, you've got it. So the point would be that we can't, or that it's designed so that we cannot recognize how our desire is satisfied, right? So it's not that we have to repress our desire. It's that we're constantly given this illusion that we could actually get the object, right? That we could get this thing that will give us this complete satisfaction that we can never get. And so that's what, and by holding out that, whatever you want to call it, that carrot out in front of us, then we keep striving for that. And we miss how, well, there's something satisfying in just the striving itself. And capitalism doesn't let you ever avow that, right? Like, you have to be constantly trying to get more and accumulate more. I mean, that's, I think, the basic. So in that way, it's a kind of traditional critique, right? Like, it's a critique of accumulation, the way this imperative to accumulate, what that does to us psychically, and how it misleads us psychically.
I think what I took away from it that I thought for me was pretty radical or revolutionary is, it sounds like you're saying we think we want the object, but what is actually driving us and what gives us the satisfaction is not getting it, and you know, we'll need to unpack this to understand how that's so. But it kind of sounds like you're saying, you know, you think you want the bigger house. You think you want the nicer car. You think that you want the nice vacation. And so you strive for those things, but that's not actually where we get our satisfaction. We get our satisfaction from the longing for it, from the falling a bit short of what we think it's going to deliver us. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's absolutely right. Absolutely right. Right. And I think to my favorite example of this, I'm a sports fan, is the way that how long do you think about your team winning the championship? Like you dream about it during the season, like you dream about it, but when they actually win, it's like, I remember when Tom Brady won a Super Bowl one time, the first thing he was is, it's going to be really hard for us to get back here and win it again next year. And I'm like, wait a minute, shouldn't you at least for like 5 seconds be like enjoying the actual thing? But no, it's already about this struggle again to do it one more time, right? And I think the worst thing that can, and I think this is true in our life, like if everything's going perfectly, we invent things that aren't going perfectly, right? Like, and the things that are interesting to talk about, like if you're talking to a friend and the friend's like, you're like, how's the things going in your relationship? They're like, you know, it's so great. And it's just, we're just getting, you don't want to hear like a long litany of how things are going great. You want to hear like, oh, it's a little rocky. Things aren't, you know, we had this fight last, then that's interesting to us. Right. And I think it's the same thing with the object of desire. Like or the commodity, like we want to strive for the commodity, but actually getting it, it's like there's something radically dissatisfying about that. So even if the commodity was perfect, it would be imperfect just because it was perfect. So we would find it wanting just because it was so perfect. It fit our exactly what we wanted. So I think that's why planned obsolescence is invented by Apple and all these other people, because they know we really want the thing not to quite work. We want it to not stop working too soon and all of these things, right? Like I think that the problem with, again, the problem with capitalism is just as you put it so beautifully, that we can't see the way in which our desire really functions and what we really find satisfying.
Do you think that this is because this is simply how human beings are, or do you think that this is how human beings have been trained by capitalism?
Oh no, I don't think it. I think capitalism. No. I don't think it. I don't think that our finding our lack satisfying or our struggle satisfying is capitalist ideology. In fact, I think the opposite. I think capitalism wants us to believe that we can overcome it. That we can really get out of struggle if we get enough or we get the right thing. So I don't think that at all. Like but I would say that it's a fact of this speaking being, right? Like it's like the way in which we are distorted from our natural being by language. That's how I would think of it.
Mm-hmm. I want to get into that idea, which you refer to in the book as signification. As I understand it, signification is the process by which humans uniquely assign all sorts of excess values or meanings to normal everyday objects that satisfy our basic needs. And you talk about the apple in the book that, you know, from one point of view, from like the animal point of view, an apple is nothing more than an apple. It satisfies a certain need for hunger. And if we were simply animals, we'd want an apple, we'd eat it, it would satisfy the hunger, then it would be done. And that's what you call the empirical apple. But if I understand it right, you say we humans, through signification, make an apple, an empirical apple, as you call it, into more than that. It becomes this thing that promises much more pleasure, juiciness, you know.
Sin.
And that sin, yeah. Tell us about how signification works.
Yeah. I mean, you did a great job of describing it, right? Like that once the signifier is attached to a thing, then all of a sudden there's this promise attached to it that there's just something more that we're going to get and never just the empirical object itself. And I think that's tied to this. I think that's what capitalism capitalizes on and then is able to present the commodity as, oh, there's even more attached to this than is present in the thing empirically. Like, you know, you go to buy a Twinkie, it's just a Twinkie. It's like, you know, it's just a piece of spongy. It's probably made of all terrible things, but that you get, there's a certain excess attached to it that even comes with the name Twinkie. It's kind of a nice name. It sounds like it's going to be great. And it's creamy and all these things that are, but those are things that are beyond, it's not just the qualities of it empirically. It's this stuff, it's this excess that's attached to it from the fact that it has a signifier aligned with it. I would just say, though, I'm not sure. I think we're kind of seeing right at this very moment that we're speaking that maybe it's not just humans, right? Like maybe artificial intelligence is also subject to the signifier in the same way, right? Like I think one of the errors that we make with artificial intelligence is that we think that it's not going to be lacking. Like we think, oh, it's going to be this perfect thing. Like, I think this is the vision of Terminator, Terminator 2. It's going to be so well, it's going to be able to take over the world immediately because it's not going to be, we're lacking subjects. Artificial intelligence is not going to be lacking at all. But I don't think that's true at all. Like, I think the artificial intelligence, if it is subjected to language, which it has to be, it'll itself be a lacking subject insofar as it can be a subject and not just everything I've seen so far is just putting together other words that already exist, right? So I'm not sure that that's subjectivity. But I think if it does become whatever, intelligent, subjectified, then it's going to be lacking just like we are. So I don't have the great fear, but I also think it does show that it's not just humans that have a monopoly on this, on subjectivity.
I want to make sure I understand what you're saying about AI. Are you saying that you don't buy the idea that artificial intelligence will ever perfectly satisfy our human desires? Are you saying that AI, insofar as it becomes its own subjectivity, which that's a whole other debate, but let's assume that's true, that's like, you know, manufactured people. Are you saying that even the robot will never be fully satisfied?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's the great, this is why I think Blade Runner is so much better than Terminator, because that's the lesson of Blade Runner, right? Like there's all the artificially intelligent beings in that film are, they're lacking subjects. They're full of desire. They're like, why didn't you make me live longer? But I'm in love with this. You know, like there are all these things that we suffer from, they suffer from too. So I think the latter point, I mean, I think obviously the first point is true too. We're constructing this AI hoping it's going to satisfy something in us, and it's not going to. I think that absolutely. But I also think if it becomes a subject itself, it will have the same problems that we do. So I don't think we should anticipate, I'm just not so scared of it like other people are, because I think it'll just be as screwed up as we are in ordinary ways.
You know, I love the way that you capture this on page 24 of your book. It's so succinct and pithy. You write, the object of need becomes an object of desire. You know, and it made me think about how I actually just got a new laptop for work, because it was really brought on by necessity. I wasn't even shopping for one. You know, my husband needed a used one. I said, take my, you know, I've had this one forever. Take it. You don't use it as much. I'll buy a new one for work. And the minute I realized I have to buy a new laptop, it becomes, you know, it becomes another thing. Oh, what color am I going to get? They've got a blue one now. Oh, but I kind of like the silver one. Is it the newest? Do I want the M2 chip or the M1? And I see what you mean. And I got to ask, for you as a person in the world, I mean, even with knowing all that you know and deconstructing all this as you have, do you still, you know, how do you buy an iPhone? How do you buy a laptop? What are you thinking when you book a vacation?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, like, it's not it would be nice. I love your example, by the way. It's so great of that exact concept. But it's not like you, and this is, I think, a psychoanalytic idea. It's not as if because I know something, I don't fall victim to it myself, right? Like our car just failed the Vermont state inspection. So and we could get it fixed, but it's got rust and, you know, it'd be a lot of money. It's 2004 or something. So it's a very old. So then we're like, we need a new car. So all of a sudden I did exactly the same thing you just talked about. Like, I'm like, okay, just a, we'll just get a little thing. And, but then I'm like, well, I wanted this nice Honda. It's got a, you know, it's electric and it's, but I, can we get an electric with a stick shift? No, you can't. Well, I don't know. So all these things like, oh, I like this metallic blue. Why would I care about the blue? But I, you know, again, like I've just the same as you're just describing, like I fall victim to that. So I don't think that there's a, I think that's the power of it, right? Like even if you see through it, you still find yourself succumbing to the logic. So I think that that's, I mean, the only thing I would say is like, I don't have money invested in any things like, you know, I don't have any, I don't have any, I haven't done any IPOs or anything. So I, so in that way, I'm, I mean, I think both this thing, the computer and the car are pretty minor things, but so in that way, I don't have an investment in it. And I don't, I try never to think about trying to make money. I try to do whatever I can to keep my income low. But in terms of like these little, little commodities, like the car and like the, like food, even like I'm like, where are we going to go out this weekend? Oh, we haven't tried that place. Let's, you know, so I think that those, in those ways, I find myself just as succumbing to it just as much as the garden variety person.
I love this line on page 33, where you really capture the letdown of every exciting acquisition that we make. You say, quote, "One thought that one was obtaining the impossible lost object, but one ends up with just an ordinary empirical object that pales in comparison," end quote. So it's like at the end of the day, it's just another car. It's just another restaurant. It's just another laptop.
Isn't that, you think that the when you drive the car off the lot, that you get that, that feeling is to me the most, it's the most concrete feeling. And like, or the moment when that new car smell disappears from the car, like all these kind of things, I think.
I mean, lots of things disappear. I feel like I know, you know, when I got my new car last year, it, I can feel like I'm trying to hold on to the newness, the exciting feeling. Cause I know, you know, in a month, it's going to be another car. And it's not that I don't enjoy it, but I hear what you're saying. It pales in comparison to what I imagine it would be when I was, you know, searching online and seeing what they have at different dealerships and do they have the silver one that I like. What I want to pick your brain a bit more about though, is I feel like you're saying, you're not just saying, look, this is a simple error in our thinking. You know, we think that the object is going to satisfy us and we don't. I think you're going further again and saying we find the failure satisfying. And I feel like my listeners might need to hear a bit more from you about like, how is that so? Why would we find that lack satisfying? What is satisfying about it?
Right. So here's my theory, if I can do it in like a quick 90 seconds or something. So it's that there aren't just objects that are desirable available to us, right? So it's only when we lose something, we sacrifice something, we give something up, that something becomes desirable to us. And then it's only insofar as we sustain that something is lost that we can continue to find something enjoyable or satisfying or desirable to us. And that's because once we get it, we close that gap and there's no, and all of a sudden that space through in which we can desire something and find it enjoyable, find it satisfying, it disappears. And there's no, and all of a sudden we're just left with a bunch of regular objects. There's no, it's only in that when there's some kind of loss or something is lacking that there's that an object gets increased in value. The thing when things are gone, and I think this is if people think about this psychically, or think about it psychically, if they think about it a little bit, I think they would see that the things that we that are lost to us or are gone are they have an increased value, right? And so that's the basic idea, and so that's why I think failure. That we desire or find satisfying the failure because that sustains the thing being gone or out of reach. And if when that gap is eliminated, then all of a sudden that space for satisfaction is gone too. And it can be stultifying, even be suffocating, right? Like all of a sudden wait a minute, I'm too close to this thing. And I know I lose this ability to find it satisfying. I mean, think about how, if you've ever been apart from the person you're in love with, and then you almost feel closer to them when you're apart from them. And then if they're like, if you're like during COVID, I think a lot of people felt this, you're with them all the time. And there's something almost like, I love you, but can you just maybe go in the other room for a while? And, or maybe move across town for a couple of days.
So that I can want you again.
So that I can find you satisfying again. Right. And I think that, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Like, I think that's just the structure of our psyche. And I think that that's really at the basis of the basis of the critique of capitalism, that it doesn't allow for that, or it does allow for it, but it doesn't allow for it to be avowed. Right. It makes us think like, oh no, what I really want is to have the object. What I really want is to have a lot of things. But no, what I really want is to not have a lot of things, right? Like to have a lot of thing, obviously not to have nothing, right? Like you have to survive in relative comfort, but to the things I find really satisfying have to be absent from me, I think, in some way, not maybe totally absent, but in some way absent.
I guess because loss creates want.
Exactly.
And that experience of wanting is its own satisfaction.
Right. I think that's the only satisfaction, right? Like that's the only satisfaction. Like I think Freud makes this distinction between pleasure. And then he only makes this distinction later when he talks about this thing called death drive, which would take too long to get into, but between, let's just call pleasure and satisfaction. And for him, pleasure is with that very momentary time when we obtain something, right? His idea was it's when we have a release of excitation. That's pleasure. But he said it's always momentary, right? Whereas satisfaction, I think, can be sustained because it involves not having. And so there's not this like, it's just momentary. And no, I think we can sustain satisfaction for a long time because it deals with absence rather than this momentary, this time of having, which only is necessarily fleeting.
I love what you say as well about how the desires of other people create or shape our own desires. I was recently booking a vacation, in fact, to a place that I've been to before, but it's been over 15 years. You know, and I had a pretty straightforward idea of the things that we would want to do and see. And then I start reading online, oh, but, you know, if you want to go to this restaurant, you got to book 3 months in advance. And if you want to go to that place, you want to book 2 months in advance. And I thought, well, before I read this, I didn't give a crap about going to this restaurant. But now I do because I see, oh, is that what everybody wants to do? Oh, I guess I want to do it now. Honey, we got to go to this thing. Can you explain that idea?
Yeah, I think you just did a great job of it, right? Like the it's only through our interpretation of what we think the other desires that we get a sense of our own desire. And I don't think that's bad. Like I think most people would listen to what you just said and they'd say, well, that's bad. You should follow what your own desire. But I would say, you don't have your own desire prior to some moment of interpreting what other people desire. And that's totally fine. I think that's totally fine. It's just when it gets caught up in this fantasy of like, oh, the other person has it all, and that's why I want to follow their desire, right? Then I think it's can become problematic because then you're it's tied to this thing that we've been talking about the whole time, like seeking fullness or this completeness in an object, and you think, well, this other person already has that, and so that's why I want to follow their desire. But no, it can just be, look, that's this thing's desirable to other people, so I'm gonna take an interest in that too. I don't see any problem with that whatsoever, because I think that's how you find out what your desire is. You know, there's this great story about the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, and he saw his brother. His name was Paul, who was a great pianist. And in fact, he lost an arm in the First World War, and someone wrote a single a concerto for a single hand for the, I forget who it was. It was Mike Webern or somebody. And he saw his brother playing the piano, and he's like, he was so focused, and he's like, just totally committed. And Wittgenstein's like, you know, I want to feel that way about something in my life, just like so consumed by it that I can't think of anything else. And then he became that for everyone else. Like everyone thought Ludwig Wittgenstein is this philosopher. All he thinks about is thought and logic and problems. And he just, the rest of the world is just nothing to him. But he only started doing that because he saw his brother doing that with the piano. And so everyone's like, that's just how Wittgenstein is. He's a genius. He's so just consumed by, no, he got that idea. But it's great. I mean, it's great that he thought about philosophy like that, right? But he only got it because he saw his brother, and his brother probably saw some other pianist like that, and he started getting consumed. So I don't think it's a bad thing. I think like that's how it just obviously depends. Obviously, if it's like somebody consumed with heroin or something, then that's probably a bad thing. But in general, I think like paying attention to the desire of the other is the way that we're not psychotic. So I think it's very good in that sense.
Yeah, it's how we figure out, I guess, our own desire. You know, what would you say is a solution to all of these traps or all of these problems? You know, what do you say to people who are listening to this and resonating with everything that we're talking about? I mean, how might they approach their own consumption, their own life in capitalism differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two answers to that question. The first is I think that we need to collectively do something about the structure of capitalism, right? Like, obviously, it's very unlikely that we're going to totally leave capitalism behind. I'm not a complete idealist, but I think there needs to be some kind of major shift in the total inequality and all these things, and maybe collectively getting beyond that fantasy attached to accumulation would be a major thing. But I think, you know, I've had several people, and they all start the email the same way. They're like, you know, you're probably going to hate this, but I really take your book, Capitalism and Desire, as a self-help book. And I'm like, I don't hate it at all. I think it's great. And I kind of wrote it myself in that way. Like I find myself caught up in that same fantasy. And so I'm constantly struggling against it. Like with this car thing, I'm like, well, maybe we should just stick with the old car, fix the rust. And it's kind of nicer, you know, because if someone hits you, you're like, no big deal. Like I was in this kind of crappy car. Someone rear-ended me at a light. Didn't it damage the bumper a little bit? And they're like, oh, we should call the insurance. I'm so sorry. I'm like, you know what? Just forget it. Let's just drive away. And they're like, are you kidding? Are you sure? And I'm like, no, it's fine. This car is already crappy. It's no harm done. And so I felt such freedom in that moment, right? Like I was, because, you know, all the things, even if it's not your fault, the insurance, you got to take it to the shop. So there's a way in which like getting out of that, like having to have the great next commodity is freeing. And I think that's where I see the help of it, like the self-help dimension of it.
I kind of agree with what this person told you there. There's a self-help, self-growth dimension, I think, to the experience of reading this book, because everyone's going to relate to it. Everyone's going to read it and say, oh my God, that's me. I do that.
Right.
You know, we're almost out of time. Before we go, you want to tell us what you're working on now or what you're up to now?
Yeah, sure. So I'm just finishing a book on, it's called something like Embracing Alienation. So it's about how you could kind of see it connects to this book in a way. Like it's about how alienation is a good thing. We shouldn't think of alienation as a bad thing. We should think of it as a positive thing. And that's going to come out sometime. But I just published a book called The Racist Fantasy, which is a critique of racism. And it's the way fantasy enables, right, underwrites racism. And another book called Enjoying Right and Left, which is about the way enjoyment is structured politically in two different ways. So those two things. And I have a little podcast called Why Theory, so where I talk about all these things with my co-host. So
can you repeat the name of the podcast?
Yeah, sure. It's called Why Theory.
And where can people find that?
That's a good question. I think it's on, it's on Apple Podcasts, but it's also on the one that everybody does.
Spotify, maybe.
Spotify. Yeah. That's it. Okay. We don't get the money that Joe Rogan gets, but we don't get anybody, but, it's on there. Yeah.
And for people who are interested in keeping up with what you're doing and what you're publishing, do you have a website or do you have social media where people can follow you?
Yeah. See, this is part of my critique of capitalism. I don't have any of these things, but I do a little YouTube thing and I do the podcast and the books are, you know, people can email me and I have PDFs of the books I'd be happy to send to people if they don't want to buy them. So.
Do you want to share your email address?
Yeah, sure. It's todd.mcgowan@uvm.edu. Sure. Yeah.
Great. Well, yeah. Again, my guest today has been Todd McGowan. He is the author of the book, Capitalism and Desire, The Psychic Cost of Free Markets. Todd, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks. It's been a great conversation. Really appreciate it.